In a few lakes in East Africa's Rift Valley, there are fish called cichlids. From what was likely one species, they've evolved into hundreds and hundreds of them, each specializing in a different ecological niche or type of food. And they did this in the blink of an eye, evolutionarily speaking. They're cited as an example, like Darwin's finches in the Galapagos, of what's called adaptive radiation. It's a process where natural selection turns one species into many species, and fast. It's this fast part that leads to some interesting questions. Evolution is driven by the slow accumulation of mutations, some of which are helpful, some of which aren't, and then selection acts on those mutations. So why would these fish or birds or a few other species be able to adapt so quickly, sometimes in a matter of generations? Is it possible that the capability to fit into a new habitat has been hiding in their genomes the whole time? Welcome to the Quanta Podcast, where we explore the frontiers of fundamental science and math. I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief of Quanta Magazine. The last few decades of advances in genome sequencing is making it possible to ask questions about taxonomy and evolution that we never could have imagined before. A recent story in Quanta called How Ecotypes Harbor the Genetic Memory of a Species Past explores some of the latest research on what makes a distinct species. The story was written by Quanta's current writing fellow, Marlo Starling, and she's here to discuss it with us. Welcome to the show, Marlo.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Marlo, what's the big idea?
So, speciation really isn't as linear as it seems on a phylogenetic tree, which are those branching trees that you might remember from evolution textbooks. And there's a surprising level of variation within a single species based on the different spaces that they inhabit in their environments. And behind these hyperlocal adapted traits are genetic changes that scientists have recently begun to decode using genomics, which is the study of not just individual genes, but the entire genome.
We have to dig into some 101 here on species,
right?
Because we throw this word around all the time. We use the word very casually to describe different kinds of living beings. But anyone who's interested in taxonomy or biology in general knows that species is a really hard thing to pin down. So let's go broad. What do we mean when we say species?
At a basic level, it's a group of organisms that can successfully mate with one another and produce viable offspring. But the term species, as you noted, has been surprisingly controversial really ever since Darwin put forth his novel ideas about evolution in the 19th century. What's really crazy is that scientists worldwide still disagree on how we define species today. There was actually a survey that was done by one of my sources, Sean Stankowski, who is an evolutionary geneticist at University College London, where he surveyed some 400 speciation researchers around the world and found that roughly 20% of them agreed on the same definition of a species.
Because if you use that definition that they can interbreed with each other, sometimes there are different species that can produce viable offspring,
right?
Or things that we would define as different species otherwise. And then we can't just take everything that can't produce a viable offspring and say, oh, you're just not a species anymore.
Right.
So it's odd. The exceptions are often what makes our clear delineation of species so strange.
Yeah, exactly. And there's also different ideas about should we lump these individuals together, even if they have some variation into the same species, or should these be considered a subspecies?
Yeah. So what's a subspecies then?
A subspecies is generally accepted to be a population that is isolated either geographically or by some other force outside of its control that might have some differences from the main species that it belongs to,
okay,
but it's not due to differences in the environment. So one example is the Florida panther in the Everglades. Back in the 90s, it was really critically endangered. It's still very critically endangered. And what wildlife managers did to help the population recover was to crossbreed the Florida panther with mountain lions from Texas. Both are part of the species Puma concolor. There are two different subspecies, but they can produce viable offspring. And this was to increase the genetic diversity within the population. So that's a good example because they're geographically isolated. That's why they are two distinct subspecies. But it's not really because of specific parts of the environment that they're different.
Oftentimes, this process, we use this word speciation, mm-hmm. which is the separation of two things into different species. And one would guess, perhaps, that if the Florida panther stays isolated for long enough, eventually it might become a separate species, and that's the process of speciation. But in your story, you talk about speciation also being a very fuzzy, indistinct kind of process. So tell us a little bit about how you, in your story, complicated this idea of speciation.
The way that it was described to me is that, like I said earlier, it's not as distinct as we see it on a phylogenetic tree, which of course is a useful tool for understanding how species were derived from a common ancestor. But there's a lot of gray area that's not conveyed on those trees that is really where the ecotypes come in from.
Okay,
this
what's
story.
An ecotype?
Ecotypes are populations of the same species, but the way that they differ from subspecies is that they can still breed with one another, but they have these hyperlocal adaptations specifically to the environment that they're in or the niche that they occupy. So different species have different roles in the ecosystem. One example of this could be an ecotype's food source. Others might be due to geographic features such as salt or freshwater, maybe differences in predators. So we will discuss some marine snails where one ecotype is exposed to crabs, which are predators to them, but the other ecotype is basically protected from those predators and so has different traits. Sometimes they're really obvious physical traits like color and shape and size. And other times they're more invisible, like behaviors or even pheromones, let's say.
We're going to define this concept of the ecotype genetically, but before we get too far into it, people who are familiar, for example, with Darwin's finches, when you said food source, mm-hmm. that would immediately call that to mind, right? Because for anyone who doesn't know, Darwin's finches is this population of birds that are on different islands in the Galapagos. They have different beak sizes and shapes depending on the food that they eat. So one that cracks seeds has a bigger, heavier beak. One that catches insects has a kind of a smaller, pointier one. I want to make it clear that we're not calling those ecotypes just yet because they weren't part of the studies that you were engaging with.
Correct.
But it does feel like eventually the conversation will go to something like Darwin's finches because they're in this category of adapting very quickly to a different food source, like a hyperlocal food source, but they can still interbreed with each other.
Right.
Okay, so let's walk through a couple of the examples. You talked about snails. I think that's where the story starts.
Yep.
So give me an example. What kind of snails are we talking about and what defines ecotypes for them?
The marine snails might be my favorite example from the story.
Okay.
This is a species called Litorina sexatilis. They live in different places, mainly in Europe. So there are populations on coastlines in Sweden and in the United Kingdom and Spain. And what's interesting is that their two main ecotypes reappear in all of those different places, even though those different populations are not interbreeding. Yet, if they bring them into a lab, they can interbreed. But those two main ecotypes, we'll call them the wave ecotype and the crab ecotype. The wave ecotype is very tiny, often has a paler shell color, very thin shell that if you wanted to, you could probably crush it between your fingers, mm-hmm. but please don't do that because we don't condone harming wildlife.
Please don't.
and they are adapted to be energetic, they move around a lot, and they can cling really well to the surfaces of the rocks that they live on in these intertidal zones because there's a lot of wave action, so they need to be able to stick to that surface.
That tracks, right? They need to be small, so they're not taking a larger portion of the wave action.
Yeah.
I guess it makes sense that their shells wouldn't need to be thick because mm-hmm. they're sticking in one place. Okay, go on.
And then there's the crab ecotype. Those are more on the shore area where the crabs also live, and crabs eat these snails. So to survive, they've adapted to have larger, thicker shells. Sometimes they're darker in color, and they have this more shy behavior where they'll hide inside of their shells or hide between the rocks in this rocky intertidal zone. And so they've evolved to be pretty different from each other. So for this story, I talked to Kirsten Johannesson, who is an evolutionary biologist and a director of the Sharna Marine Laboratory at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And back in the 80s, she was studying these snails, and at the time, her advisor thought that they were different species. Along the way, she was like, no, this is the same species. And she had been studying these snails for a while, and in the late 80s, a really bad algal bloom came to Sweden, blanketed the coast with this lime green nasty stuff. And for those who aren't familiar with algal blooms, they're really dangerous for the ecosystem because it depletes the environment of oxygen. Mm-hmm. So often these come with really massive fish kills, and it kills other types of wildlife in the area too. So a lot of her snails died, which she was really sad about, of course, because she had spent so much time studying them.
Yeah.
But she also realized, well, maybe there's an opportunity here. Some of these isolated rocks where the wave ecotype lived were now vacant. And there were still some snails that survived. And so she and her 3-year-old daughter at the time, which is really cute, mm-hmm. went on a little adventure collecting as many snails as they could. And she thought, well, what will happen if I place the crab ecotype snails on the wave ecotype rocks? Let's see.
Okay.
And the really interesting thing is that those crab ecotype snails over time started to resemble the wave ecotype. And to be clear, this was not like the same individual is somehow morphing into the wave ecotype.
Yeah.
This was happening over years, not weeks, not days, like year after year, she would come back and check on this population.
Right. That's still selection, the way that evolution does it.
Yes.
But you're saying over years, evolutionarily speaking, years is nothing.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
And she had thought too, well, maybe there's some other factors here that I'm overlooking. Sometimes species have floating larvae where these offspring are floating to another area and then they pop up there. But this species does not have floating larvae and they also can't swim. So really every possibility that she could think of for another way that this could be the wave ecotype coming from somewhere else was really not possible. So yeah, this is definitely natural selection as Darwin conceived of it.
Mm-hmm.
But is there something else going on here? Because how is it somehow magically evolving the same exact traits that the wave ecotype needed to live in this particular environment?
And so quickly, right?
Right.
So let's recap this a little bit. On the shore, we have two different environments, mm-hmm. very distinct, one in the waves, one on the shore where there's crab predation. You have the same snail, okay, and that this can be confirmed because they can interbreed or that they're genetically identical, these two snails. One is small and white, and one is larger and brown.
Mm-hmm.
If we take the larger brown ones, we put them in the wave environment, presumably the larger and browner they are, I don't know, whatever makes them their shore ecotype.
Right.
Is not going to be advantageous in that setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're more likely to die. There will be some of them when they reproduce that will be smaller and whiter, and they'll go in that direction. This is evolution playbook 101.
Yeah.
Nothing strange about that.
Mm-hmm.
The random mutations that are advantageous are the ones that are going to survive. However, we're not talking about small variations, one mutation. In order to go from big and brown and thick-shelled to small and white and thin-shelled, that's a lot of genetic content that's changing, right?
Yeah.
So genetically, how would that work? It doesn't sound like the typical evolution story as we understand it.
Exactly, because normally this takes not just decades, but centuries and millions of years sometimes for those mutations to come
about.
Yeah, like
if it happens fast, it's thousands of years.
Right.
Like that's fast.
Exactly. Okay. So let's start with chromosomes, right? Those are those X-shaped things you might remember from biology textbooks that contain our DNA. And when gametes, which are eggs and sperm, are forming, those chromosomes get torn in half and the genes get shuffled around, which is a process called recombination.
And this is what happens when any offspring is a product of its two parents.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
And this creates the genetic diversity that we see across our planet today. It's what keeps populations healthy and robust. And there's a lot of different ways that these genes can get shuffled around during this recombination process. And sometimes they do this thing where they get stuck together. And that's where things get interesting for ecotypes. So scientists are finding that one particular type of structural rearrangement in the chromosomes is super widespread across the ecotypes that they've studied. Those are called inversions. And that's when one chunk of the chromosome breaks off, flips around 180 degrees, and plugs back into the chromosome.
And this is just a random thing that often happens when you're jumbling together two very complex sets of genetic code.
Yeah.
It's not unusual for something to go just a little haywire, something flips around and plugs back in backwards.
Totally. Okay. And scientists have known about inversions for a long, long, long time. It was just once they started looking into the ecotypes, oh, these inversions are present here. This is interesting.
Okay.
And so what that does is it reverses the order of the genes. And the important part is that it also prevents that shuffling from happening again. So it's effectively locking that set of genes in place so that it can be inherited again and again and again.
The set that's in the inversion part.
Correct.
So by getting flipped around, it is less likely or it doesn't get reshuffled the way that it would otherwise.
Correct. There's a really good analogy for this that one of my sources provided. Patrick Nozzle, who's an evolutionary geneticist at the French National Center for Scientific Research, and he talked about it being like a deck of cards. Normal recombination shuffles that entire deck of 52 cards completely. But with inversions, it's as if you taped, let's say, four cards together, and that section can never reshuffle again.
Now, where we're getting to is you presumably can see in the snails, for example, that a suite of traits, like a phenotype for a thick shell, brown shell, bigger, is all together and stuck together in a way that it doesn't get reshuffled every time the snails reproduce.
Right.
So that makes the ecotype separate. And that there's a separate one for paler shell, thinner shell, smaller.
Right.
Okay.
So to complicate this, there's another way that this can happen that scientists have more recently found in the ecotypes, but again, have been known for a longer time. These are called translocations, and this is more on the newer side of the ecotype research, but what happens here is that one chunk, instead of getting flipped around, it gets moved to a totally different part of the chromosome. And Patrick was telling me that when this happens, it's usually kind of messy, so genes can still be deleted or added somewhere else at the ends of those breakoff points. And he thinks the ecotype traits might not arise just from the fact that recombination is prevented in those areas, but also that this might create a new mutation on a part of that genome that then is inherited in subsequent generations.
Right, right.
And then there's this even crazier phenomenon that he has observed in the stick insects that he studies, which is called an inverted translocation. It's basically what it sounds like. It's both of those processes happening at the same time. But it's really interesting that they're observing that in this particular species. Why does it matter locking them in place? Well, that means that if an ecotype finds itself in the other ecotype's environment or conditions, say the crab ecotype snail finds itself on that wave-battered rock, it can essentially redeploy those genes over many, many, many generations, allowing it the flexibility to adapt and survive. And one way that scientists say this is helpful to think about is by thinking of it as like a super gene.
Okay, I'm starting to see it now. We have a clump of genes that fit together that establish a phenotype that is evolutionarily successful. It's adapted for a particular environment. When we recombine genes, things always get shuffled up. These parts won't get shuffled up. They will stay there.
Yep.
But if you take the brown snail and you put it on the rock, eventually, just through random mutation, the switch might get flipped back.
Yeah.
And you might end up then with the white thin-shelled variant. And that one is then going to be successful in that environment and survive. But it's all happening within the same species, which is, I think, what makes it interesting.
Yes.
That would allow a population over a relatively short period of time, evolutionarily speaking, to switch between two different types for that.
Precisely.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does this have to do with the idea of speciation?
So scientists aren't totally sure, which is why this is so fascinating. It does seem, in some cases, to keep species from speciating.
Right, because they don't have to at that point. They can just kind of flip between the modes.
Right.
And in a larger population sense, as conditions require it.
Yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know? Yeah. But yeah, there's a really good example of this that's also mentioned in the story, which are three-spined stickleback fish. The two ecotypes, put simply, are a marine ecotype and a freshwater ecotype, and it can essentially switch back and forth. And it's been doing this for millions of years, and scientists know this because they've analyzed genomic data. And over that amount of time, you would expect by now, over millions
of
years.
Them to have diverged,
of course,
right.
But they haven't. So that's one theory, is that it won't actually create two different species.
And you could see why it would stay a distinct species, because having two different ecotypes, having that built-in rapid flexibility is itself adaptive, right? Again, this is just hypothesizing about what all this means, right? You're less likely to evolve as a population. You're less likely to split into populations because you have this sort of built-in adaptive resilience.
Yeah. But at the same time, scientists haven't completely ruled out the idea that this could be a step in speciation. It's something that some researchers really want to continue probing and looking into.
They're fuzzy, right?
Yeah.
Defining speciation's weird. In certain populations, ecotypes could be leading to speciation. In others, it could be actually holding it back.
Exactly.
Right.
And again, how do we define a species? So,
So coming back full circle to Darwin's finches, for example, or the cichlids in Lake Victoria, those were not part of any of the studies. But what would we have to do to extend this concept to something like Darwin's finches?
Sean Stankowski and Kirsten Johannesson actually wrote a review earlier this year that attempted to put forth some criteria for defining ecotypes. So at least there's some consistency with how we label ecotypes as opposed to species. And they basically argued in that review that Darwin's finches and the Lake Victoria cichlids are ecotypes. And there's a really interesting visual in that review showing the level of genetic variation between those different groups on this scale of 0 to 1, with 0 being you are the same exact thing genetically, no difference.
Mm-hmm.
1 is you are a completely different species. And the finches and cichlids ranked pretty low on that scale. And that's based on a lot of genetic data that's been accumulated over the years that they're able to analyze. To answer your question directly, we would need some kind of genomic analysis to see if maybe there are inversions and translocations and other structural rearrangements happening in the chromosomes of those species to really confirm that. And I think it also probably comes down to the scientific community agreeing on how to look at this, because this wasn't in the story, but in the bird world, species is the unit used to differentiate between different types of birds. And it's very culturally accepted that that's the case, which is why—
In the culture of ornithology specifically.
Correct, yeah, yes.
Okay.
So those types of differences, I think, are what are holding us back from expanding the way that we think about this. And I think reviews like that that Sean and Kirsten worked on hopefully are going to help the research community come together and have some consistency so that we can start to work some of this stuff out.
Yeah, and to add another interesting wrinkle to all of the different madcap ways evolution shapes life.
Yep.
I love talking about wildlife biology and taxonomy. It's just a fun area because there's a lot of stories and thought experiments within it. So everyone should check out Marlo's story. Marlo, thanks for coming on and talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Before we let you go, we'd like to ask all of our guests for a recommendation. So what's exciting your imagination this week?
This might be a little bit too on the nose, but I have a couple of subspecies tattooed on my arm.
Really? Okay.
I do. So I have a Florida panther on my shoulder, and I also have a Florida reef gecko tattooed on my arm, which is a much lesser known species, but is endemic to South Florida, right around where I grew up. And I promise this is relevant.
Okay.
I listened to this great podcast recently that is really well done and also mildly concerning about whether tattoos are toxic. whether the ink is toxic. It's a Science Versus podcast. It's a great listen. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, man, that's really scary and concerning to hear some recent research that is potentially linking certain types of ink to certain types of cancers and other diseases. But I think the interesting thing is that the hosts and even myself were kind of like, is that going to stop me from getting another tattoo? I don't know.
This is audio, so no one can see the expression on my face, but I have a tattoo appointment tonight.
Oh my gosh.
So
that's awesome.
And it's not my first. So, gosh, okay.
Sorry I need to listen break to that podcast to you on the day that you're getting a tattoo.
Well, thank you. We'll check it out.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Samir.
Also on Quanta this week, you can read an excerpt from the first release from Quanta Books. It's called The Proof in the Code by Kevin Hartnett, and it's about Lean, the program that's being used to verify math proofs. You can also check out an essay that explores the history of strange work that appeared to show that memories can be eaten, at least by certain kinds of worms. We're going to leave you today with the sound of one of Darwin's finches, the small ground finch. It's worth noting that these birds aren't actually true finches, but tanagers. This particular species is found on most of the islands in the archipelago and eats primarily seeds, flowers, leaves. The recording was made by Robert I. Bowman and comes from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and the Macaulay Library at Cornell University. If you've been enjoying the Quanta podcast, please take a moment to rate the show and leave a review. We'd love to hear from you. The Quanta podcast is a podcast from Quanta Magazine, an editorially independent publication supported by the Simons Foundation. I'm Quanta's editor-in-chief, Samir Patel. Funding decisions by the Simons Foundation have no influence on the selection of topics, guests, or other editorial decisions in this podcast or in Quanta Magazine. The Quanta podcast is produced in partnership with PRX Productions. The production team is Ali Budner, Deborah J. Balthazar, Genevieve Sponsler, and Tommy Bazarian. The executive producer of PRX Productions is Jocelyn Gonzalez. From Quanta Magazine, Simon France and myself provide editorial guidance with support from Samuel Velasco, Simone Barr, and Michael Kenyangolo. Our theme music is from APM Music. If you have any questions or comments for us, please email us at quanta@simonsfoundation.org. Thanks for listening.